Welcome to VR for Care Talks, a podcast series that explores the barriers, facilitators, and context of use of virtual reality, otherwise known as VR, in children's healthcare.
I'm your host, Jessica Ding, a registered nurse and a master's student in advanced practice nursing. Before we begin, a quick disclaimer. Virtual reality has been used in certain contexts in healthcare with caution, while continuous research takes place. The contents of this podcast are for general informational purposes only and do not serve as medical advice. Institutional policies should be followed. The views and statements shared in this podcast are solely those of the hosts and guests.
Today's episode will explore the aspects of decision-making when implementing VR into children's health. Joining us today are Kelly Thorstad and Dr. Hemdi. Kelly is a nurse practitioner and the Director of Nursing and Patient Services at the Shriners Hospitals for Children Canada. Dr. Hemdi is a renowned orthopedic surgeon at the Shriners Hospitals for Children Canada. Welcome, Kelly and Dr. Hemdi. Thank you both for joining us today. Just to start off, could you please share your professional title and role in children's health, as well as your experience with virtual reality in your practice?
So I'm Kelly Thorstad. I'm the Director of Patient Care Services Nurse Executive at Shriners Hospitals for Children Canada. I initially started at the hospital as a clinical nurse specialist and then trained to be a nurse practitioner, so have been able to work directly with the patients and families that we serve. And I recently, in 2017, moved into a leadership role as the Director of Patient Care Services Nurse Executive, which has allowed me to really invest in the programs and innovations that we develop at the hospital, which is why I am so pleased that we have virtual reality that has been implemented with our patients and families. I took the lead from my amazing colleague, Dr. Hamdi, who is always searching for innovation, and he is the one that actually partnered with us at the beginning in nursing research to bring virtual reality to our patients and families. So I'll pass it over to my colleague to introduce himself and how we got on this wonderful journey of virtual reality implementation.
Thank you, Kelly, for the very kind words, and thank you, Jessica, for having inviting us. So I'm Rich Hamdi. I'm a pediatric orthopedic surgeon at this hospital. I've been working here for many, many years. I think I am one of the most senior person, and I always was treating children with complex disorders, which is very challenging. And as Kelly mentioned, the virtual reality, the birth of virtual reality here several years ago, when we introduced virtual reality to the hospital, first as a research project with Sophia Edamp for her master degree. And then the importance of virtual reality really went very, very quickly. And what we can do with the virtual reality is just amazing in not only relieving pain and anxiety, but from my side, if we can do anything outside the operating room, in the clinic or on the floor, that has huge, huge advantages. And in general, advantage of virtual reality far outweigh any disadvantage. So I'm very happy to be here to talk about virtual reality.
So VR sounds like a very interesting anxiety and pain control strategy. Could you expand more on what interested you in VR that made you advocate for its implementation in your institution?
Why we picked up on the idea to continue with the implementation of virtual reality is that we are very committed at a hospital that serves children, of course, to try to minimize stressful, painful interventions. And so we strive to look at everything that we can do for pain management. And when we saw that virtual reality had a role in decreasing not only pain, but also anxiety and helping to alleviate the stress, not only in the child that was undergoing the intervention, but also in the parents that needed to watch their child in distress, we felt we needed to make sure that we really did a true implementation based on scientific evidence and through a proper process so that we could ensure that we were delivering the best optimal care to our patients and giving them as many options as possible to experience a stress-free and traumatic-free experience while they are with us.
In addition to all what Kelly was mentioning about the advantage, I think one of the main things, virtual reality. Traditionally, the control of pain has been pharmacological, this means biomedicines. And the big difference virtual reality is, can we avoid the use of specifically narcotics or opioids in the management of pain? And the answer is yes. Pain is a very complex thing. I'm not going to go in because I don't know much, but it's a very complex mechanism, multidimensional. If you can control or manipulate the areas that can control pain, then you have done a great job. And virtual reality can manipulate the environment, the attention of the child, and the anxiety. And by controlling or manipulating this, then you can control the pain. So you don't need medications. It's a non-expensive thing. It costs almost nothing. Very easy to apply. You can apply it anywhere in the hospital, in the clinic, on the floor, in the guest room. And it doesn't take almost no human resources and minimal equipment. And the children love it.
Do you find that there are inconveniences and risks to implementing VR? If so, how did you account for them?
So what we found with implementation of VR into clinical practice is that we wanted to monitor it to ensure that it was meeting the needs of patients and families and not causing a conflict or delays in actual treatment of care. So whenever you are looking at introducing a new modality, you need to look at the feasibility, the clinical utility and acceptability, the clinical efficacy, the tolerability of the patients, and you need to ensure that it meets the right needs for the right population. And so we didn't just say, here's VR, go off and do it. We made sure that we were looking at each of those components, that we were checking back with the patients, with the parents that were present, and also the healthcare professionals that were using the modality to ensure that, one, we had the right equipment, two, we had the right programming that was appropriate for care for the patients that were using the VR, that there were no unanticipated or unwanted side effects that were impeding the care that we needed to give, and that it was actually doing the job that it was intended to do.
Definitely. I mean, I have very little to add. All these aspects have to be analyzed before the implementing virtual reality in our hospital. The availability of the trained person, whether nurses or PT, is extremely, extremely important. Like if you have one person who knows how to use virtual reality in the whole hospital, that's not practical. Because when we need virtual reality, we cannot say, okay, we need virtual reality tomorrow after tomorrow. It's almost on the spot that we need this, whether you change a cast, you remove a cast, you remove a needle, you remove external fixator, this thing, the dressing. We have to demonstrate availability, the training, all these things are important before implementing it.
So once you looked at feasibility, availability, and safety, what were the next steps that needed to be taken to implement VR?
So as we were moving through the different steps of going through scientific evaluation of VR and different projects that we had our students working on, we then needed to shift into the clinical utility aspects. And in order to be able to do that successfully, we assigned one of our clinical nurse specialists to look at a scoping review of the equipment, the availability of software and hardware, looking at what was best practice across the industry, evaluating the different headsets that were available. And it was quite a lot of intense work. The individual that we tasked with this quite enjoyed the challenge, but she herself was surprised at how much work went into making sure that we were making good clinical decisions. What was most comfortable for patients to put on their head, what would not interfere with, for example, an IV insertion or a different procedure. You don't want the headset to be too bulky. She looked at the different costs. There's some headsets that come with the programming embedded in the headset. There's some that you can use a more generic headset and get the different software programs that you can tap into that meet different patient needs. And it's not just about, hey, here's a VR set and go ahead with whatever game. You want it to be proven in the literature that it's appropriate for clinical care in a pediatric healthcare setting. And so all of those different steps were taken and put into a chart that we could use not only at our hospital, but that we'd be able to share with others, because we wanted our experience of implementation of VR to be transferred either within our healthcare system, as we're part of the Shriners healthcare system, but also to other partners working in healthcare that wanted to also implement virtual reality into their settings. And a lot of work was done to be able to identify that evaluation and what are the best steps, most successful steps for implementation. And then, as Dr. Hamdi previously mentioned, you need to have the right professionals trained to be able to use the headset. You cannot plan for tomorrow or next week to have the headset per se. You have a patient that is before you and you may need the unit now. And so we have looked at a variety of different healthcare professionals and have done their training. And that has been an interesting challenge for those who want to look at implementation, because our teams would go to the initial student who was doing her master's and always call her to come to do the virtual reality. But we needed to help develop the reflex for individuals to either use child life services or to use the physiotherapist that was trained or to use the social worker that was trained or to use the nurse that was trained, that it cannot be a one-man show, as Dr. Hamdi mentioned, because you need to be able to have the care at your fingertips, which requires champions throughout your organization. And that, I think, was one of the key areas that we needed to focus on. And it didn't just happen overnight. We needed to go back and redo some trainings and remind individuals and help our healthcare professionals to be very comfortable with the use of virtual reality.
The whole point is how to make a very complex thing look very simple. Someone from the outside thinks virtual reality, or what, you just put a Google, you just put your thing, and that's it. But Kelly mentioned it's not as simple as that. And the danger is that if we start implementing a certain work or something that has not been well prepared, well studied, it can lead to disaster. So I think it was the work that was done was, I must say, amazing. I mean, virtual reality by itself is not new. I think it was used for burn patient, which is one of the most painful things, is to manage wounds in burn patient. But in the pediatric world, it's recently, and whenever you deal with children, you have to be very careful and have to be very sure of what you are doing.
Thank you for highlighting the crucial steps of implementation and the benefits you have seen. So once the evidence has been reviewed and safety of the children ensured, what are the resources and costs required to implement VR into the healthcare setting?
I think the concept of the cost and considerations for any organization is important. I think we were very fortunate because we began with our project being under the realm of research, which gave us a lot of background and feedback as to how to be successful with clinical implementation. And it is true that there are costs associated with the use of virtual reality. You need to either purchase individual headsets and the rights to use the different software that can be uploaded onto the headset, or you need to purchase the license to use the hardware that has the software embedded, and that's on an annual renewal basis. So that needs to be thought of when you're planning in your operational costs of any healthcare organization. I think that the training, of course, takes manpower, but that is why when we did all of our implementation, we wrote out the guidelines, we wanted to be able to share, and I would encourage any organization to look at best practice, what's in the literature, so that they go right to the heart of the issue and choose wisely from the beginning. But as we know, technology changes very quickly. And so you can be purchasing one item and then the next day it's out of stock or out of interest, and they've moved on to other things. So you do need to be aware of that, but also build that into where you're going. Don't invest too heavily in something very expensive, because tomorrow it may change and you need to maybe upgrade. So there are basic costs of licensing and purchasing of equipment, but then there is the supporting cost of your individuals around. But if you do it wisely, you can be cost efficient with it, and you definitely will get the beneficial rewards back for your patient care, despite the operational costs that it incurs.
From my side also, I mean, these are the direct costs. There is the savings that virtual reality can do. For us surgeons, ideally, we would like to keep the operating time and the anesthesia time for it's very precious, the OR time. So if we can keep it for cases that you can only do in the OR and many other minor cases, like it's pin removal, external fixator, the things that used to be done in the OR, but now because of virtual reality, we save this operating time. And this operating time, I think it's about what, $1,000 an hour, extremely expensive. So if you look at the savings that a virtual reality program can do, it's simply phenomenal. So that's the other, which should come into the cost effectiveness.
Since its implementation at your hospital, have you seen the results of VR use?
One of the things that has impressed me the most with the use of virtual reality in the clinical setting is when I heard a testimony from one of the parents of their child who needed to come here on a regular basis to receive IV infusions. And that IV infusion, it was a regular part of that child's life and treatment of care here at the hospital, but it caused a lot of anxiety for that individual, that he knew that they were coming up, he knew it was painful to have an IV insertion, and it caused stress for the whole family unit, especially his mother, who felt so sad because he needed to do it, there was no way she could prevent it, and there was really not much that she could do to help support him throughout it rather than be there for him or hold his hand. And she said that once they started using virtual reality during the IV insertions, that her own child was no longer afraid, no longer had the anxiety, was ready for that headset to come on. And that took off so much stress and anxiety for her as the parent that she no longer had to endure that. And that just touched my heart because we are helping her so much to not have to watch her child suffer. So that just brought in an entirely new perspective for me in one of the benefits of the use of virtual reality.
Another benefit, which is very practical one, because there have been some studies comparing the can you distract or the distraction process that is going on virtual reality, can you obtain it using it?
A tabloid
or thing, and something very stupid. To as Kelly was mentioning, you can take off the VR of control it with one hand only. You don't need two hands, but to control an iPad or a tabloid, you need two hands. And very often there are children multiply injured or for whatever other reason, burns or whatever. They don't have the use of both hands. So virtual reality, a small practical reason, can be very, very, very.
As we wrap up, what do you think are the next steps in the process of implementing VR at your institution?
So our next steps for establishing virtual reality as an integral part of our practice is to continue to have the dialogue and the focus groups with patients, families, and the healthcare providers. As you use different innovations, you cannot just say, okay, it's done and walk away from it. You need to make sure that the programs are uploaded, that they are the best scientifically proven software that can be used at the time. You need to look if there's other usage that it can be useful for. You need to constantly be making sure that it's a dynamic process and it's not something that's static. And I think for us, we are always looking at different opportunities to evolve, to improve upon things. And I think for us, of course, since research is very important to us, to make sure that we're studying it and sharing that knowledge with others and to ensure that it continues to be safe, it continues to be useful, and that it's not a burden for the patients and families or the healthcare providers, but that we make the ease of use as simple as possible, but that we have it available as a modality because we have seen such benefits with it.
Again, that's Kelly summarized the whole thing. Where it's going, said number one, pain control without having to use medications or opioids. That's one big thing. Number two, can we even do minor surgical procedures under virtual reality instead of general anesthesia? Oh, this, that could be the big thing. And the third thing, I think if by having interviews or podcasts like the one that you are doing to let everyone know the wonderful job that is being done here in the hospital, that will help us.
Well, thank you very much, Kelly and Dr. Hamdi, for sharing your insights today. It has been truly incredible. As always, if you made it this far, thank you for listening. In this episode, we explored the executive-level decision-making processes for implementing VR into a children's hospital. We looked at feasibility, clinical utility and acceptability, clinical efficacy, and patient tolerability, as well as ensuring that VR meets the specific settings and patients' needs. Our guests highlight the importance of sharing their experiences, guidelines, and resources with partners. For continuous implementation and training champions in VR to ensure timely use and availability of VR. If you're looking for more VR resources, see the link in our description to access our virtual hub for virtual reality for childcare. Once more, a big thank you to today's guests, Kelly and Dr. Hamdi. In the next episode, we explore the troubleshooting efforts made from the ground up by bringing the research and clinical teams together for optimal implementation. So I hope you stick around and see you next time.